Hello and welcome to another edition of A Presence on Your Journey, a podcast of Community Autism Resources. Today we're going to be discussing a very serious topic, and I have a little bit of breaking news for both our guests, which I will get into when we get into the topic, something that just came over our local radio station this morning in Fall River. And our guest today is the author of the book Pain and Shock in America. I'm going to have her go through the whole title because it's a rather lengthy title, but it's Pain and Shock in America to start with, and that is written by Jan Nisbet and Nancy Weiss. It's a pleasure to have both of you, and this is a very serious topic, and it concerns Behavioral Research Institute out of Rhode Island and the Judge Rotenberg Center, which is located in Canton, Massachusetts. This is a very appropriate topic right now because I learned this morning that we have a resident of Fall River who is at the Judge Rotenberg Center, and the school committee needs to vote on a $160,000 contract for this individual from the Massachusetts Office on Children. They're going to make an on-site visit to the Judge Rotenberg Center late this fall. Given the fact that I don't know what late this fall means in terms of narrowing down the date, since today's date is November 17th, but it's late this fall, they're going to do an on-site visit to the Judge Rotenberg Center, and then the school committee has to sign off on the contract. And this is for one resident. So I think this is a very timely topic. So I want to thank you both for joining us, and I want to thank Jan for the book. I've read the book twice. It's very, very comprehensive and very emotional. So I'd like to start with maybe a brief background for both of you. I'd like to start with the author, Jan Nisbet, and then go to Nancy Weiss. So we'll start with you, Jan.
Thank you, Dennis. So I've worked at the University of New Hampshire for almost 35 years as the founding director of the Institute on Disability, and then as the senior vice provost for research for the entire university. I spent my life, my graduate school as well as my career, focused on people with disabilities and how to support people with disabilities in schools and jobs and in communities. So the topic of the book, which is the use of painful interventions and shock on people with disabilities, you know, has been on my mind for many, many years. And Nancy, fortunately, I was almost done the book when I became the senior vice provost for research. I put pretty much the entire contents of the book underneath my desk, and Nancy called me prior to me leaving that position and encouraged me to finish. And so she was much more knowledgeable at this point of some of the more recent events, and finished the book, and she was a major contributor to that effort.
I know the book is about advocacy and politics, as well as describing some of the treatments in the book. It's very comprehensive. I'm glad you decided to finish it. Nancy, can you give us briefly your background?
I too have spent my whole career in the disability field, and in 92 was hired as a consultant by the state of Delaware to go visit all of their young people who had been placed in out-of-state facilities. It's not unusual for states to find, especially school-age kids, who they feel that they can't appropriately serve and they send to out-of-state residential settings of one kind or another. I went as part of that effort to the Judge Rotenberg Center. It was then called the Behavior Research Institute, and it was located, as you said, in Rhode Island. They've since moved to Massachusetts and changed their name to the Judge Rotenberg Center. But I spent just 2 days in that facility back in 1992. And came away personally changed, and have worked since then in all kinds of ways that I could figure out. The very first thing I did, so I was so horrified by what I saw on that visit, was called the Amnesty International and said, I want to speak at your conference about what I just saw there, because this is torture. I told them what I saw, and they said, is this home for juvenile delinquents? And I said, no, it's a school for kids with autism. And they said, oh yeah, well, we don't get involved in that. And basically that's been the approach of many people since then. As soon as they hear that it's for people with significant disabilities, they wash their hands of it. Amnesty International said, we don't know what people like that need. So that's as far as I ever got with Amnesty International and getting any interest. But it started, you know, a 40-year process of me being committed to seeing this place close down and being in touch with a lot of former residents and a lot of parents whose sons and daughters were there, just trying in every way I could figure to get stopped the truly horrendous, frightening, and awful things that happened there.
Let's get into this. What is the history, and what exactly is the Behavioral Research Institute, and exactly what kind of research do they purport to do?
Well, that's a really excellent question. As Nancy said, it's now called the Judge Rottenberg Center after Judge Ernest Rottenberg, who really made many of the decisions that kept the school open and allowed it to continue to use aversive procedures. But the history goes back to really, you know, the time when behavior modification was believed to be kind of the end all. There was a lot of research going on, not at the Behavior Research Institute. It's not a research center. Never was a research center. In fact, there's only been one study ever published that was published in a referee journal, and that was a European journal. There's never been any research published there that's been published in a U.S. academic journal. So the history is that, you know, behavior modification was thought to change things, and during the 60s and the 70s and into the 80s, it was even permissible and endorsed by the National Institute of Health to use punishment to supposedly suppress problematic behaviors. But it was also during this period of time that new programs were being developed that employed only positive practices. So there was a clash, a historical clash. And so there were professional organizations such as TASH, Autism Society of America, later on, condemning the use of punishment and painful procedures such as shock. And then there were other professional organizations who continued to endorse it as a way of managing problematic behavior. And so what this book tries to convey is that history and how we got to this place where we have this one center in Massachusetts that's allowed to continue to use painful electric shock on people with disabilities. And it's a long story, and it's a painful story. And it's filled with anecdotes about lawyers. Eric McLeish, who represented the center, and his law firm were extremely effective attorneys and were constantly defending the practices. And as a result, two commissioners from the state of Massachusetts who tried to shut down or stop the use of these procedures were ultimately terminated, fired, resigned. One was actually fined, Mary Kay Leonard, for doing her job. So it's important to recognize all the players and the competing agendas.
There are actually many characters in the book, but the two major, major characters I want to go into are Dr. Matthew Israel. Let's talk about Dr. Matthew Israel first, because I believe he was the founder of the Behavioral Research Institute.
I'll start, Nancy, if I forget anything, jump in.
Yep.
So, you know, Dr. Israel has a PhD from Harvard in experimental psychology. He studied with B.F. Skinner, you know, who was really kind of the father of behavior modification in the United States. He was a very strong supporter of the use of these procedures. He also has a law degree from Harvard Law School. And what's important in terms of his background is at the time that he was the executive director, he was not a clinical psychologist. He had never been trained to work with children, adults, people with disabilities. I believe that his doctoral work was on pigeons and responses of pigeons. So, you know, he was able to be in charge of this center that were using these procedures, despite the fact that he had never been trained to work with children with disabilities or adults with disabilities. And he persisted with the help of lawyers throughout and always and continued to advocate for these very painful procedures, arguing that they're better than drugs and better than being, you know, in institutions. So that was very convincing to Judge Rottenberg.
So,
Nancy, would you add anything to that?
Only that eventually he was indicted not for torturing children, but for destroying state's evidence in a very interesting situation where, you know, we really haven't discussed yet what actually happened there, but just in a nutshell, children and adults who are there wear a backpack that has an electric shock device in it and with wires that go to their arms or legs or bottoms of their feet or palms of their hands or stomach. And that device, although Matthew Israel for many years would say, it gives them, you know, a small reminder shock. Or one time he said, the shock is no different than when you take your sweater over your head in the winter and you get a little static electricity shock. However, eventually a piece of videotape became available that's still available on YouTube. A young man in 2002 came into a classroom and the staff person told him to take off his jacket and he didn't. He didn't give her the finger. He didn't say anything. He just didn't. And so he was shocked for refusing to follow directions. And then he was laid spread eagle, face down, strapped down on the floor, and shocked another 70 times. The first time for failing to follow directions, the next 70 times for either screaming while being shocked or tensing his muscles in anticipation of the shock. And so that piece of videotape, now people knew that this was not a tingling reminder. This was a horrendously painful fall on the floor, screaming in agony level shock that the United Nations said wouldn't be legal if used against convicted terrorists. So here we're doing it to, you know, kids and adults who have disabilities. Anyway, Matthew Israel was indicted because there was a situation where a young man who lived in one of the group homes that is run by the facility ran away. He called the group home and told the staff in the middle of the night to wake up people out of a dead sleep and give them shocks because he said that he was from the facility and that they had missed an opportunity to shock somebody, that these two young men had done something wrong during the day. Tied these two young guys, woke them up. They were, of course, insisting they hadn't done anything because they hadn't. Tied them up, tied them down, spread eagle the way they do, restrained them. Gave one guy 29 shocks and one guy 41 shocks. And this so became known as the prank because eventually it became known that it wasn't the facility calling to say shock these guys. It was a former student or a student who had run away. When the state investigated that incident, there was videotape of the incident. And the state told the facility, don't destroy this videotape because this is now part of evidence in this situation that we're investigating. And Matthew Israel instructed a staff person to destroy the videotape. So he was indicted for destroying state's evidence and worked out a plea bargain by which he had to leave his relationship with the facility. So he moved out to California where his wife has been all these years, who also at that time ran a facility that wasn't dissimilar and, you know, then began working with her out there.
Kind of reminds me of the indictment of Al Capone for tax evasion rather than murders.
Yeah, very much so.
He had experiences, it's mentioned in the book, of starting communes. Jim, can you describe that? Because I have a theory.
There's not a lot of information on these communes, but again, he was very much enamored with B.F. Skinner and some of his writings. And, you know, B.F. Skinner wrote about communes where, you know, the organizing principle was behavior modification. So he had a group of people that he was living with, and he does tell the story about a young girl who was living in the commune who was acting like a young girl, in my opinion, who he ended up, you know, kind of giving a painful, you know, pinch, and that it worked. And the one thing, you know, that people need to know about punishment is punishment works only temporarily. And you have to escalate the punishment, the level of pain, because people end up getting used to it. And so, you know, part of the Matthew Israel and the commune, that's where he kind of started with the idea that behavior modification could be an organizing principle and had some success that he describes with this young girl. But it's also really important to understand that over time, you know, if you look at the history of the Behavior Research Institute and the Judge Rottenberg Center, the devices that were developed by, you know, the GED, which is the graduated electrical deceleration device, became stronger and stronger and stronger and had to use more painful shock because people were getting used to it. And so, you know, as the years went on and more shock and pain were used, they employed higher levels of pain. So I don't know, you know, in terms of Matthew Israel and his communes, to me, it was a platform, a launching pad for his work in Rhode Island and Massachusetts.
I think for the record, it's important to point out that eventually, I think B.F. Skinner himself disavowed the methods that were being used. Can you clarify that?
Well, he actually, at one point, was supportive and was interviewed by The Globe and described Matthew Israel as a decent human being, and that what he was doing was in the best interest of the children. But over time, as the procedures and practices and deaths became apparent, he disavowed the use of the painful electrical shock.
What is the status of Dr. Matthew Israel right now? I think he was...
Nancy, you want this one?
He's in California. He got in trouble in California for practicing psychology without a license. There's been a history of that, of him at one point calling people psychologists. They gave him the title of psychologist, regular staff people who had no specific training in this area, and then billing Medicaid for psychology rates. So at some point, he's basically been told in California that he cannot continue to practice. His wife's schools both closed down. They now run some kind of community center where people with disabilities can go for different kinds of services, but I don't know if it really is operating or if it just kind of looks that way on paper. So,
California very early on passed a law to essentially stop the use of the, pain and shock. At one point, very early on, Matthew Israel was going back and forth between Massachusetts and California. And California, I would say, got its act together, passed regulations that made it almost impossible to employ these kinds of procedures. Massachusetts never did that.
So how did we get from Rhode Island to Massachusetts? How did Judge Rotenberg Center open in Canton? How did we get there? From Rhode Island to Massachusetts?
Well, it was in Providence, Rhode Island, and the state regulations in Rhode Island just started to become onerous for him. And so, Providence is not far from the Massachusetts border. So he had always run group homes in Massachusetts. One of the problems federally is that there are no federal regulations that say, there are federal regulations that apply to different kinds of facilities. But, you can call yourself a residential treatment center, you can call yourself an intermediate care facility, there are different types of regulations. So he figured out ways to kind of slip and slide, and eventually, there should be federal regulations that just say, look, if you provide A, B, C, and D, you're this under federal regulations. You can call yourself a health spa if you want, but, you still have to follow these regulations. And so he moved to Massachusetts because he found a more regulatory, acceptable,
friendly
environment that where he could continue to do what he did. And, lots of people, to be clear, this electric shock is going on to today. There are still, as we speak, students there, and they're not really students because it's not really a school, and most of them are adults. Many states have stopped sending people with severe disabilities there. So most states won't send people with significant autism or cognitive disabilities. Instead, they have now hired attorneys, and for many years have hired attorneys in New York City, contracted with attorneys in New York City, to find kids, young people who are getting in trouble with the law, to go to those people's families and say, look, your kid is going to court next week. He could be sent, or next month, he could be sent to a juvenile treatment center, basically juvenile prison. I could represent your family at no cost because, of course, the Judge Rotenberg Center is paying him. I usually charge $600, $700 a day or an hour, but, I'll represent your family at no cost. And we could get him into this beautiful, and it is physically beautiful place. If you saw pictures, you'd think, well, this place looks nice. And it won't be on his record that he went to juvenile prison, and he'll get treatment. And so what parent doesn't want that for their troubled kid? I've just interviewed about 35 people who had been there, and not one of them has a disability. When I say to them, how did you get there? What happened? Their stories are, I was kind of a tough kid. I cut school a lot. One guy said to me, I wasn't a stellar student. I got my girlfriend pregnant in high school. Another boy pushed her against the locker, and I hit that kid, and then we both got in trouble, and I got sent to the Judge Rotenberg Center for having a fight in the hallway in high school. One guy said to me, my parents were getting divorced. The judge wanted me to pick which parent to live with. I didn't want to do that. The judge thought it would be better for me to be somewhere else for a year or so while this all got settled out. They sent me to the Judge Rotenberg Center.
Yeah, so in the 70s, it was primarily children and adolescents who had been labeled as having autism and or severe behavior disorders. Today, as Nancy says, the big population are people that have entered through the legal system and have been placed as alternatives to jail. But, you know, in the 1970s, the head of the Human Rights Committee for the Developmental Disabilities Council, his name was George Nazareth. He was a father. He had a son with a disability. When there was a death and Rhode Island pulled out all their students. And so Rhode Island would no longer allow any students to go to the Behavior Research Institute, although they continued to license it as a special education facility. And so when it totally moved to Massachusetts, its base, it was in part because Rhode Island no longer would allow any of its students to attend that school.
I want to go on to some of the strategies of state officials, because it's very frustrating, as I read the book, why this continues, all efforts to try to end this form of behavioral treatment, why it persists and continues in Massachusetts, which is labeled as a progressive disability state, at least according to all the meetings that I've gone to in my life of advocacy. It seems to me this is a big blotch on the Commonwealth. But there are heroes who have tried. And so I want to go into some of the strategies that state officials tried to use to end aversives. And actually, before we do that, let's define the term aversives for our listeners.
Well, simply, aversives are the application of painful stimuli or any procedure that causes pain. Extreme pain.
So originally they didn't have the electric shock device when I visited. They were just inventing it, but they used other horrible kinds of things. They had staff people grow their fingernails so that they would hold up their hand and you could see their fingernail over the back of their finger, so they could get rolling pinches that would pull off a little piece of flesh. They designed giant spatulas. They would pull down people's pants and spank them with giant spatulas. They would use water spray. They would use jalapeno pepper to the mouth. When I was there, I saw a little
food deprivation.
Food deprivation to this day. I mean, there's not one person I've interviewed who doesn't talk about the food deprivation program. They often will keep people on a small percentage of the number of calories it would take to maintain their ideal weight. And then they have very unpalatable food. When I was there, I watched a little girl. I was in the room. I didn't even see what she did. They marched her into another room. They made her kneel down on a little wooden bench. They strapped her feet down behind her and her hands on a bench in front of her. They put a helmet over her head that came down around her chest like a welding helmet with a, had a little window in front of her eyes, but that was painted black. There was white noise blaring in her ears and a water spray pumping water into her face. And she had to stay there until she stopped struggling or crying for 15 minutes. She was only about 7 years old. She was there for an hour and a half, probably, until she just exhausted herself. It was just tragic. And when I was there, and still, they have people earn portions of their food. So you wake up, you don't get breakfast, you earn little tiny paper cups, like the kind you might get salad dressing in the restaurant. You earn a tablespoon of your food from the time you wake up until noon. You can earn a tablespoon of your breakfast at a time. From noon to four, you can earn a tablespoon of lunch. If you haven't had any food by 4 in the afternoon, they give you ground chicken with liver powder cold, because they don't want to be accused of starving anybody to death, so they give them the most unpalatable food that one could imagine so that they can get some nutrition. But so everybody talks about being starving.
So those are some of the aversives. But to jump into your question, Dennis, about the heroes, I mean, Nancy may have different heroes, but, you know, I think there were two parents, Barbara Cutler and Martha Ziegler, who were tireless advocates, who constantly went to the press, who held protests. Gunnar Dibwad, who was on the Human Rights Committee, who was at Brandeis University at the time, was an outspoken advocate. He had a great deal of credibility in the disability community. Mary Kay Leonard, who was a young attorney who took over the Office for Children, who, after Vincent Miletich died, did an investigation, brought people in to look at their procedures. But, I mean, the dilemma was that attorneys never argued, the state attorneys never argued on the basis of what you would call constitutional rights, right? So it wasn't like a 14th Amendment case, equal protection under the law. They didn't argue the Rehab Act of 1973, the special education law around least restrictive environment. What happened was the argument was around jurisdiction, like who has the right to regulate and stop the use of aversives. And so with Mary Kay Leonard was the commissioner for the Office of Children, she stopped. She forbid them to use aversives. And there was a young woman, she's been written up, whose name was Janine Kasoria. And they filmed her after they stopped the use of aversives on her. And those videos, and she was acting out, you know, she hadn't had what we would call today a positive behavioral plan. It was all based on punishment. And those videos were shown to Judge Rottenberg. And so after Mary Kay Leonard stopped the use of aversives, her parents petitioned the court to, essentially, they asked the court to take over guardianship of their daughter and make a substituted judgment about what was best for her. So Judge Rottenberg, after seeing her in person and seeing these videos, essentially made a substituted judgment that she needed these procedures and overrode the Office for Children and Mary Kay Leonard. Now, Mary Kay Leonard tried to persist, but the attorney, in particular, Eric McLeish, argued that she was trying to destroy the lives of these children and these families needed this, and she had no right to do it. And she was conspiring with experts to shut the place down. And it, unfortunately, it ended up being a compelling argument for the court.
And I believe her successor kind of ran into these similar battles. I think his name was, I know
Phil
his
Campbell.
Last, his first name was what? I'm sorry.
Philip Campbell.
So he kind of ran into these same battles. We had two commissioners of the Office for Children that tried to, you know, cancel the contracts or shut the place down.
So after Mary Kay Leonard, you know, was essentially forced to leave, they transferred jurisdiction of the center to the Office of Mental Retardation. That's what it was called at the time. Phil Campbell was the commissioner of mental retardation. He had been a former director of an ARC in Massachusetts, had been an outspoken advocate for community services and deinstitutionalization. And so he was very systematic and brought in a Rivendell evaluation team to evaluate what was going on. But, you know, it's ironic because he did want to shut it down. He wanted those practices to stop. And so the argument the attorneys used is that he was biased and therefore he couldn't be fair. And therefore Judge Rottenberg, you know, was given evidence that Phil Campbell was trying to shut down the school. And he was, you know. He was at least trying to stop the use of those procedures, but it ended up making Bill Campbell and his team, who met on a regular basis to talk about strategies to stop the use of aversives, to be co-conspirators.
That was the Tuesday, I think it was called the Tuesday
Morning
Group. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What about the legislature? Why was it so difficult and still is difficult to ban this form of behavioral treatment?
You want to take one? No, you take a shot at Nancy, then I'll give my opinion.
For one, because there are parents whose sons and daughters are there who will say, if not for this place, my kid would be dead. And there have been five people who have died there under their care. But I do think that once a parent makes the decision to allow their son or daughter to go there, they have to convince themselves and the world at large that they are doing right by their kid, because every parent does. And so there are many parents who then something horrible happened to their child there, their adult child, and changed their tune. But, you know, people always say to me, like, what parent would send their child there? Well, for one, the system has failed parents and people with disabilities, so that there aren't always good places for people to get the support that they need. Many states, you had said earlier that it cost $180,000 per person per year. It actually costs more like $290,000 per person per year. And that's just for the base cost. Then almost everybody has a one-to-one staff person. I just reviewed the record of one person who's there currently. his cost is over $400,000 a year. So it's incredibly expensive, and there are community providers in every state. They're usually nonprofit agencies that are state-funded through a combination of state and federal monies. And those agencies will serve people who have significantly challenging behaviors, but most states don't want to pay their in-state providers those kinds of rates. So there are people who are significantly dangerous. Not everybody there is, and it's normal to think that that is true, but there are people with disabilities who are dangerous to themselves or others. They can be served, and many people from JRC have left there and been very successfully served in community settings. But they might need a staff person with them one-to-one all the time, or even two-to-one all the time, and that's expensive. And so,
and then some of the legislators have, you know, there's one in particular who has a nephew who has been at JRC for many, many, many years, you know, and he's been a very strong advocate. He has lobbied internally with the legislature. David Cohen, who was the mayor of Newton, and then a legislator before that, I believe, he submitted I don't know how many bills that never got fully passed. JRC had lobbyists. So, you know, you have parents who are testifying in front of the legislature. You have people with disabilities who show up, you know, they have their backpacks on. Their stories are told, the before and after story. And then you have legislators who are actively lobbying their colleagues to not passed legislation forbidding the use of aversives. And not really, it wasn't until the prank that Nancy described that the Boston Globe, which is a very influential newspaper in Massachusetts, came out against the Judge Rottenberg Center and its use of procedures. Prior to that, the Boston Globe supported the Judge Rottenberg Center Behavior Research Institute during Mary Kay Leonard's attempts and during Bill Campbell's attempts.
They called for her resignation.
Pardon?
They called for her resignation and firing.
Absolutely,
yes.
And they, you know, demeaned Bill Campbell throughout his attempt to stop the use of aversives. So you've got legislators, you've got parents, you have people with disabilities, and you have this very powerful communicator, the Boston Globe, who's saying, hey, these people need it. And as Nancy says, if you can step back and realize, you know, in the 1970s, we didn't really even have good, for example, communication strategies for people who had autism or were nonverbal. But, you know, we didn't have statewide effective early intervention, family support, preschool. I mean, family support legislation didn't get passed until the late 1980s or early 1990s. So a lot of things happened when people, as Nancy said, there weren't programs to support them. There weren't programs to support families. There wasn't early intervention. There weren't a range of, you know, available communication strategies for people who were nonverbal and were communicating through their behavior. So much of that has changed now.
There was a...
JRC.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say that JRC will say that they're the only place that can serve people with these kinds of severe behavioral situations. But the truth is they serve maybe 260 or 280 people at various times. It's not exactly clear how many people are there. But those aren't the only people in the country that have severely challenging behaviors. In every state, there are people whose behaviors are severely challenging who are served by community agencies in effective and humane ways. So there's a whole science now and a whole art of serving people with behavioral issues that looks to what is that behavior about for this person? What are they trying to accomplish with their behavior? What did they used to get when they acted that way that might have maintained that behavior? How can we make sure people's lives are better and fuller and richer? And if somebody says, you know, I want more breaks, or I want more communication, or I want more attention, how can we build a lot of that in so that they don't need to behave in ways that are so challenging? So there's just a much more loving and humane approach that's been effective that now could serve everybody who's there well. And those states that have taken people from their state back have proven that people who are there don't need to be there. They can be served in their home states much more humanely and make with progress.
The Massachusetts Office on Handicapped Affairs, which is now the Massachusetts Office on Disability, had recommended a strategy that the background of Matt Israel should in fact be part of the overall state strategy. Given the whole controversy in this area of behavioral treatment, why wasn't that strategy followed?
So at one point, an external attorney was brought in from Pennsylvania, who recommended that there be a more intense look at sort of the organization and money and tax status and et cetera, et cetera. That didn't really ever take off. The concerns about Matthew Israel's background was that, you know, essentially he was grandfathered in as a psychologist under the Massachusetts Psychological Association. Because, you know, he has a PhD in experimental psych, but not clinical psych. There was a lot of discussion at one point about that fact, but he went through the process to get grandfathered in, so it didn't really have any legs in terms of being a legal strategy. If that's what you're referring to, Dan.
Yeah, yes, yeah, it is.
People are afraid of them because there's been so much. They're very litigious. They spend hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on lawyers. When some former employees spoke at a legislative hearing in Massachusetts in 2014, I think, they got draft libel suits in the mail. So, I mean, the JRC didn't say, we're suing you. They said, look, here's what a lawsuit will look like. Oh, actually, that was in 94. And so that was a long time ago. And so they have a reputation of suing people who speak out or ruining their lives. And so people are understandably cautious.
There was a woman who recently received her PhD from the University of Massachusetts who wrote a letter to the editors, how I would describe it. She had just, you know, learned about the Judge Rob Burke Center fairly recently, was appalled. She has a degree in special education and submitted this letter to an online newspaper. I think it's The Patriot, but I'm not sure. And that online publication immediately got a cease and desist letter from the Judge Rottenberg Center because they accused her of making allegations that they were responsible for some of the deaths. And, you know, to be totally fair, you know, when there were inquests into the deaths of the people, JRC was never held responsible for the deaths. It was always attributed to their disability, not the fact that they were being, you know, punished or ignored or not given the appropriate treatment. She pushed back, that online publication pushed back, refused to take down the letter, and nothing happened. But that's how aggressive they are.
They just threatened to sue an autism organization called Neuroplastic in the same way. They didn't like what they had said in a position statement, and they reached Judge Rottenberg Center, threatens to sue a little grassroots autism organization.
I want to talk about lawyers and judges for a minute, and this whole thing ended up in a probate court. What were the qualifications of Judge Rottenberg to be making decisions on treatment plans? How did this end up in the probation court? Is this the right court to be handling these issues?
Well, you know, probate courts tend to handle family affairs, right? They're local courts, and so issues surrounding children and families will often end up in front of the probate court. And I think it was a very smart move by JRC's attorneys to put it front of the probate court versus a federal court or even a state court, and it became a treatment issue. It wasn't a federal issue. It wasn't a state law issue. It became a treatment issue. And did Judge Rottenberg have any training? No. Was he convinced by the stories that he told and the visits that he made and the videotapes that he saw? Yes, he was convinced. And he bought into the idea that the state was conspiring to shut down the Judge Rottenberg Center, the Behavior Research Institute, and he became their strongest supporter. And any case that went in front of Judge Rottenberg to limit the use of painful procedures never, ever got any place.
What was the background of Eric McLeish? Because he turned out to be their lead attorney.
So Eric McLeish has got a really interesting background. He had done really important work, deinstitutionalization work in Massachusetts in particular. It wasn't Belchertown, it was Bridgewater.
Bridgewater.
It was Bridgewater State Hospital. And he had recognized the poor treatment and lack of treatment and had been a really strong advocate for people with disabilities. He was also the attorney in the whole Catholic priest scandal in Massachusetts, and he represented those victims. So he saw himself as representing people who needed treatment, who needed care, who needed support. And he was very good at what he did. I mean, I talked to many attorneys who went up against Eric McLeish, and they said, I wish I was him, you know, that I could do what he could do, that he's very charismatic and compelling and hardworking and aggressive. So, you know, he came out of a pretty strong advocacy position and took that, and we would argue, obviously, was on the wrong side of the issue.
I would like to go into the area of contingent electrical treatments and specifically electrical items like the GED and the amount of voltage that we're going through, and I don't know if they still are, but we're going through a lot of the people who are getting treatments there, including that nasty incident of the former patient who called from off campus and triggered that incident that led to Judge Rotenberg's resignation. Can we talk about the contingent electrical treatments and what they were, and why they kept getting approved, or why they were approved by, you know, organizations like the FDA at one point and the NIH?
All right, so they were never approved by the FDA, but the original device, which is used nowhere else in the country or the world, was developed. The Judge Rotenberg Center hired electrical engineers to develop a device, which they said was substantially similar to a device that was already on the market. And that device was substantially similar to a device that preceded it. And the first device, which was called the whistle stop, preceded any requirement for devices to be approved by the FDA.
Right.
So the whistle stop was developed before there were any requirements. The next device, which is called the Cybus helmet, is a helmet that somebody wears when they bang their head, they get a very mild shock to their arm or leg. That got not FDA approval, but it was able to be used because they said it was substantially similar to the whistle stop. And then when the Judge Rotenberg Center developed the first graduated electronic decelerator, they said it was substantially similar. So it was all substantially similar. At one point in 2010, I wrote to the FDA and said, you know, they're saying all over their website that it's FDA approved when you know and I know it's not. You might want to do something about that. So then promptly 10 years later, the FDA tried to do something about it. But just to put it in perspective, a cattle prod delivers 0.4 milliamps of electricity at peak, 0.4. And the current GED, which is called the GED4, because as Jan said, they keep having to increase the power of it to have it have control of people, delivers 91 milliamps of power. So 0.4, I mean, nobody would want to be hit by a cattle prod. Way more than an electric fence, way more than a cattle prod. There was a professor of biomedical engineering from Washington and Lee University, James Eason, who said the lowest shock given by the mildest graduated electronic decelerator is roughly twice what pain researchers have said is tolerable for humans. And what's important also to understand is that you don't get a shock when you're about to put your fist through a plate glass window or gouge at your eyes. People get shocks for closing their eyes, for not following directions, for stopping work for more than 10 seconds, for failing to maintain a neat appearance, for getting out of their seat or off the toilet without being told, for interrupting, for swearing, including saying things like, oh God, you know, I spoke to a woman whose native language, I mean, her first language was Spanish, she would get shocked for speaking Spanish. Somebody said to me, I would get shocked for sexual gestures. Well, the only sexual gesture I could think of was giving somebody the finger. She said, oh no, I blew a kiss to a friend of mine across the room. So,
and I think with Nancy, the whole issue of substantially equivalent, so the FDA, you know, approves things to be marketed, pre-market approval. In order for things to be approved by the FDA, there have to be clinical studies. There has to be data that supports the use of these procedures. But the idea is that all of these devices were able to be used because there was an argument that, oh, it's similar to this. and then it's similar to this, and then it's similar to this. And the device got stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And as you know, in the book, the FDA did finally, after a well-organized effort and petitions, banned that procedure. But the U.S. Court of Appeals overturned that ban because they argued that the FDA did not have the authority to act like a doctor. And they essentially said that they were issuing a medical opinion and that the ban was only for people with developmental disabilities. And there are a range of devices that use mild electric shock for bedwetting, for smoking, and those devices weren't banned. So the Court of Appeals said, if you're going to issue a ban, you have to issue a ban for everyone. It can't just be for people with disabilities. And so even though the FDA took hours and hours and hours and hours of testimony from people, from doctors, from scientists, from families, from people with disabilities, and issued the ban, it was overturned by the courts once again.
There's quite a detail in your book about the NIH conference that was, I think it was the NIH. I kind of get confused between the FDA and the NIH. I wonder, can you describe how that works, if there's a brief way to describe it?
So the National Institutes of Health have a consensus process. And what that does is it brings together all the research on a particular topic. And, for example, diabetes. And it says, the current state of the science, based on these published studies that meet a gold standard, they're typically randomized clinical trials, is this, which means, you know, this is the amount of insulin, this is the time of day, this is the diet. So it's typically been for what I would call standard medical issues. So after the Office of Children decision, and Mary Kay Leonard essentially being fined for trying to shut down the Behavior Research Institute or its use of aversive procedures, a group of people got together and thought, well, if the NIH gets together and reviews this, they're never going to support the use of these kinds of punishing procedures. And so originally the NIH didn't want to do it, but they got convinced that they should do it. So they bring in all of these behavior researchers from across the country, and they have a standard for studies. And the studies typically have to be large groups of people, randomized clinical trials. Now, where did most of these studies take place? If you're thinking about a large number of people with disabilities that you can randomly assign treatment to in a controlled way, institutions. So a lot of the studies that were out there that were published in journals using pain as a procedure to manage behavior, the ones that met an NIH publication standard were done in institutions. And so the community advocacy organizations, the community researchers who were doing single subject design work, who were saying, you know, we looked at five people and all five people, we use these kinds of practices, and lo and behold, they're not self-abusing anymore. They're not aggressing anymore. But those studies, because they were small and they weren't in a controlled environment, were not taken into consideration. So when they looked at all the research that had been done, they said, well, if you look at all the published research, you know, the use of punishment works. It controls behavior. And they didn't say use it all the time, but they said in certain cases you need to use it. And so, you know, the advocacy community that thought the NIH would solve their problem. But what the NIH did was they reviewed the existing literature and said, yeah, it works.
Which nobody argues that it works, but at what price? You know, I've spoken to anybody who's not traumatized for life and has post-traumatic stress disorder as a result for having been there. So
is there any research that documents the long-term effects of this method of treatment?
No, because it's hardly ever used. I mean, that would be a good research project for somebody to try to. First of all, this is, like I said, the only place in the country, and as far as we know in the world, that uses electric shock as punishment. Important that we don't confuse this with electric shock that's used in a different kind of way for people that have severe and prolonged depression. That's a whole different kind of thing.
That's ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. They should not be confused, and sometimes they are.
Okay.
So, I mean, it would be great. This is the only facility that uses it. It would be great for somebody to dig up everybody they can find who had been there, who had been subjected to electric shock, and look at. But what we do know, just from interviews with people, what the impact is of having been, first of all, just living in an environment where no choice is your own. You don't choose when to take a shower. You're observed while you're showering. Every time you get up out of a seat, you have to say stepping up. Every time you sit down, you have to say stepping down. You're not allowed to talk to anybody. You're not allowed to communicate with your family. So just the trauma of being in that environment would be worth studying, even without the punishment. And, you know, so many of the people I've interviewed said, I would so much have rather been in prison. Some of them later or before that were in prison. And they, you know, one person at one point got sent from JRC to a psych hospital. And she said, I begged them to keep me there. I begged them, please keep me in the psych hospital. It's so much better.
An organization that has the word research as part of its organization, has anyone ever held them accountable or asked what kinds of real research that justifies the word research in their name? Has anyone bothered to hold them accountable for that?
The theory is that's one reason they changed their name, is because people would say, where's the research? And as Jan says, they haven't published any peer-reviewed. Any researcher knows that if your research is of good quality, the way you get it out is you submit it to a peer-reviewed journal. There are dozens and dozens of disability-related and behaviorally related peer-reviewed journals in this country. And if their research were defensible, they would have some stuff published. They do have a number of articles on their own website. They weren't of the quality that would have been accepted in a peer-reviewed journal. And so, no, there is no research that they've done that meets the standard of research in the scientific world today.
Well, and, you know, they were, during both of these trials, you know, Mary Kay Leonard and Phil Campbell and certainly some of the other, I mean, there would be members of the academic community who would come and say, oh, these procedures that they're using are great, they work, they're scientifically appropriate. So, you know, here's a judge, not trained, right? And then you have members of the academic community that are supporting the use of these procedures. And then you have other members of, you know, scientists who are saying these are unnecessary and shouldn't be used. And so there was this constant kind of battle going on where there wasn't consensus. I mean, you know, just yesterday, the Association for Applied Behavior Analysis International, for the first time in its history, and has really, that organization has been probably the most aggressive supporter of these kinds of procedures, passed a position statement that essentially says, we do not endorse the use of contingent electric shock under any circumstances whatsoever. That's absolutely huge, because they have been kind of the big holdout in this professional disagreement over the use of pain.
Every other mainstream disability organization has a position statement against it.
Yeah, I saw that statement. I was going to ask you about that. And what are some of the other advocacy efforts? And do you imagine a day, or is there ever a time where you see aversives being banned in Massachusetts?
I imagine that day all the time. It's a bit of a pipe dream. Advocates have been working on this for more than 40 years, 50 years. Yes. And so, you know, Jan talked about some of the heroes being state people who really have fought this battle. The other heroes are people with disabilities themselves and advocates. One of them, we open the book with her story, Jennifer Musumba, who in 2013 wrote a letter to me explaining her, she was a resident there, explaining her experience there. And at first she wanted to remain anonymous, and I helped her to just take out a few things in the letter that I thought might make it identifiable, like what year she was there and what state she was from. But eventually she decided she did not want to be anonymous. She wanted her name out there. Her letter was very powerful, and I sent it with her permission, of course, to the Department of Justice and the FDA. And they both those federal agencies asked to interview her by phone, because I think because they wanted to make sure she wasn't a figment of my imagination. She's incredibly well-spoken. She has an incredible memory of things that occurred there. She's done a lot of writing. She just published a book about her own experience there. So I really do think it was her voice that got the Department of Justice and the FDA to finally start the process of doing something about it. Another person is Lydia Brown, who for years has kept a running record of every related document on the internet.
Ari Newman, who's been a force in, you know, the self-advocacy movement. And, you know, to go back to the heroes, you know, one of the things, Dennis, that has changed is, you know, in the 70s and 80s and 90s and even into the early 2000s, it was parents and professionals, judges, lawyers, administrators. Those were the people in the room. But now that's changed. Now self-advocacy community is coming forward, speaking on their own about what they want, what they've experienced. And, you know, when you ask about, is there hope that Massachusetts will pass a law outlining these procedures? If Massachusetts does, I think it will be because of the self-advocacy community and not necessarily the professionals and parents that have been out there, you know, for so long. So I guess I have hope. And I know right now there's a group of people that are working on trying to get the practice guidelines for, like, if you're certified to be a behavior analyst, that you cannot use contingent electric shock. So they're trying to use professional guidelines rather than the typical legislative or legal process.
I think it's more likely there will be some federal legislation or some federal controls that will stop it. Then the question that you ask is the question that everybody asks, and it's really the question that Jan started writing this book in response to, is you tell this story to the next 10 people you pass on the street, they're going to all say the same thing, which is, what? How could that be legal? Wait, that's happening now? You're not talking about something that happened in the 1930s or 1950s? How could that be legal? You couldn't do that to your own kid. You couldn't decide, my kid has a behavioral issue and I'm going to give him an incredibly painful electric shock. Why is it legal for professionals to do it?
Well, Jan and Nancy, I want to thank you both for taking the time to really go over this book. And I hope people will pick it up and read it, because it was a hard book to get through. I read it twice. The second time was...
So Dennis, just if people are interested in the book, you know, it's published by Brandeis University Press, and it can be ordered through Amazon. And the full name is Pain and Shock in America,
yep.
Politics, Advocacy, and the Controversial Treatment of People with Disabilities.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for going through the full title. And it is available through Audible as well. So it is available. There is audio access to the book. So thank you both very, very much. Thank you for doing this podcast. And most of all, thank you for writing this book.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Dennis.
A Presence on Your Journey is a podcast of Community Autism Resources. Barbara Domain is our executive director. Nick Domain is the producer. You can access this podcast and any information regarding Community Autism Resources by going to our website, http://www.community-autism-resources.com. And you can also access this podcast in any way that you access any podcast, Spotify, for example, Alexa. Just ask for Alexa, play Community Autism Resources, and you can access the podcast that way. My name is Dennis Polselli, and thank you for listening.